This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And of course, if it's Monday, it's Rethink the Week. But before we rethink, we need to grab again Colonel Vindman. His testimony before Congress in the fall of 2019, it was about the impeachment hearings. His words were powerful and emotional, and they made you proud to be an American. Maybe the most proud part was when he assured his father that it would be all right. And as we've come to learn, it's not all right for anyone, not for him, not for his brother, not for the country, probably not for the world. Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
And as I've told people, in November, I want those words of Vindman in your head. I got another thing I want in your head. Remember Wisconsin. That's another thing. By the time we get done, this could be like a checklist of everything that's going to have to be in everyone's head as they go into the voting booth. But this is our Rethink the Week panel, so let me welcome them to the program. We have Dean Spiliotis. He is a presidential scholar and a civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog called nhpoliticalcapital.com, and you hear him regularly on Friday on NHPR for their end of the week review. Thank you so much for joining me, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
And we have my good friend, Rick Newman, who I have known for, God, Rick, probably almost 40 years now. Rick Newman was a former legislator. He is currently a lobbyist from the state of New Hampshire, and he is originally from Canada. So let me welcome Rick to the program.
I always like to remind you that it's Newfoundland. We just happen to be from Canada.
Okay, sorry, Newfoundland. Joining us also is Val Endres. Val Endres is a political communication professor from Rhode Island College. And boy, political communication is now an incredible skill set, Val. You are probably in demand all the time. Analyze this. Follow this. Where is this going? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arnie. Great to be on the show.
All right, everyone. I wasn't sure where I was going to start, but I have no choice. About 17 seconds before the show began, I went to my Facebook page, and I want to remind everyone that we're now doing this via Zoom, and therefore we're doing it on Sunday night so that you can hear it on Monday. And this is what I posted. Clorox outperformed itself. A twofer. It eliminates germs and viruses and Trump pressers. A grateful country thanks you. So, Dean, since you didn't hear us talking about this because you came on a little bit later than everybody else, let's talk a little bit about what happened last week with Donald Trump and his 40 or so press conferences. But he had the shortest press conference on, I believe it was Friday, and that was after one of the most embarrassing and potentially lethal press conferences that he had on Thursday, where he made the suggestion that since disinfectant works so well on metal and plastic and countertops and wood, that maybe if we just sort of put some Clorox into our system, whatever those disinfectants did to the outside, it could do to our lungs. It could actually maybe fight COVID-19. Horror appeared on the faces of many people at that press conference, including Dr. Birx. But it turns out that maybe in some ways that disinfectant did something else. It convinced everyone around Donald Trump that he should stop having these press conferences.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had been saying that. I think some folks in the White House have been saying that for a while, but he really looked forward to them. It really was kind of like oxygen for him, much like the rallies that they have replaced. But he was so roundly criticized, and even some of the folks on Fox did not come to his defense. And so I think at least for now, it seemed to kind of get through to him that maybe these were counterproductive. And he attempted the next day to say that, you know, he wasn't being serious. It was a sarcastic comment to a reporter, you know, which is insulting because you can look at the tape and see he's clearly talking to his advisors who were sitting off to the side of him. So that didn't work either. And I think finally he just decided, at least for now, that maybe these were being counterproductive, and the poll numbers have started to drop for him. So we'll see how long this lasts. But at least temporarily, it seems like he is going to take a break from them.
So, Rick, you mentioned that there were some really interesting numbers coming out of New York regarding people calling some sort of emergency, like hotline or poison line, about having maybe consumed Clorox. But what I want to reveal to this group, as well as to my audience, is that, like a good doobie, I read The Guardian newspaper. And while this didn't appear in many other papers, it did appear in The Guardian. Here's the headline. Revealed. Leader of group peddling bleach as coronavirus cure wrote to Trump this week. Mark Grennan wrote to Trump saying chlorine dioxide can rid the body of COVID-19 days before the president promoted disinfectant as a treatment. And in his letter, he says, a powerful bleach used in industrial processes, such as textile manufacturing, that can have fatal side effects when drunk, is a wonderful detox that can kill 99% of the pathogens in the body. He added, it can rid the body of COVID-19. Well, Rick Newman, we know that Donald Trump doesn't read much. I wonder if he read this letter, Rick.
Maybe Hope Hicks read it to him late at night, you know, in the residence. But somebody, I wouldn't be surprised if he got wind of it somehow. I mean, it was bizarre to watch that episode when he was looking at his advisors. And just the poor the looks on their faces of, you know, watching this man talk about putting, well, it's okay, right? We could try it. I know you're looking at it. And they're thinking to themselves, what's he talking about? Makes you wonder where he got the idea. But what struck me with that headline the next day about, they said cases of ingestion of disinfectant type products doubled over the same period last year. And my thought was, well, how in the world do we have a problem that people are ingesting disinfectants in New York? I just don't understand what's going on out there anymore.
Yeah, but Val, let's be honest. The people that are probably ingesting disinfectants are probably 5-year-olds and 3-year-olds and 2-year-olds. And his mother is calling hysterical, going, my child, my child. And that's something that we have seen happen before. The new spike in numbers, I think it correlates directly to people that are listening to President Trump. And let's remember that sometimes what really scares me is that people are so wedded to him that this has become such a cult, and he is such a cult phenomena, that they want to prove he's right, Val.
Yes,
prove
I think
he's right.
I think that's true. I mean, it boggles the mind that he has the following that he has on nearly every issue. And even when the videos, like you mentioned before, prove that he wasn't speaking sarcastically, they will literally and figuratively swallow whatever he has to say. But I wanted to say one other thing about this, and that is, this is the result of not having a functioning White House staff, because all presidents, to some extent, there has to be somebody there, a chief of staff among them, a strong chief of staff, who can protect the president from himself. And they would be the people that you would bounce ideas off of, that you would monitor the mail, monitor the emails, limit the amount of information that the president gets. And president's human, and as a result of that, sometimes they listen to the wrong sources. Particularly with Donald Trump, this is very problematic. And as he has decimated the White House staff, this is the result of it.
Yeah, but Dean, I hate to break it to you, but the way Trump is running the White House is the way he ran his business. He ran his business as a small family business. There, he didn't have employees. You know, I mean, that's not how he operates. And this isn't because he doesn't have good people around him. It's because he has made a conscious decision that the only person of import, the only brain that matters is his. This is mm-hmm. all, this is not about a failure of an administration. This is about a flawed madman who has made a decision that only he counts, that only upon his advice, that he gets to pick and choose what he wants, that he can reject something or blame someone else, even when he finds out he's made a mistake because he's not capable of making a mistake. And I love you, Val, but that's, you're treating him like he is the president of the United States. He happens to have that title, but that's not how he's functioning. He's functioning like this is the Trump family business, Dean.
Except for Arnie, I think it's all the more reason that you have a staff in place that can protect the public from his worst self. And I think you need, I mean, that's one of the functions of a White House chief of staff, is to monitor the kind of communications that come in. I completely agree with you that he's an extraordinary office holder in that he defies logic. But you need, that's all the more reason why you need strong people around him who will speak truth to power. And
they
that's
won't
the last. Problem.
They won't.
Well, Dean, yeah, go yeah I mean, this is the argument that we've had since the beginning of his administration. That was supposed to be, you know, Kelly
adults.
And Mattis and Cohen yes. and McMaster. And he very systematically worked to eliminate those folks. Anyone who pushed back against him, Reince Priebus, I mean, you can name the number of people who have fallen by the wayside. And so he's very actively worked to get this to a point where he has the leadership set up that makes him comfortable, which is essentially a version of his family business in which he's unchallenged. People only affirm his decision making rather than countering it. I mean, there are people who, you know, there are some anecdotal stories of Dr. Birx kind of talking to him very gently and others kind of maybe shaping his thinking gradually. But that seems to be not the standard. So, I remember when he first became president, wondering how long it would take him to get to this point, because it was very clear that's where we were headed. So, you know, he has no use for bureaucracy. He sees bureaucracy as conspiratorial, as pursuing interests that are inimical to his own personal interests. I mean, that's just his default.
Dean, it's not bureaucracy. It's anyone. It is anyone. It doesn't, I mean, he didn't have bureaucracy at the Trump family business. He didn't have bureaucracy when he was dealing with the banks. Anyone,
yeah.
I mean, he sees everyone as sort of the opposition because it's all about him. And
right.
you know, we
well,
all
the
say,
whole
hey,
concept of an infrastructure
yes,
is
yes.
not useful to him.
Anathema.
That there's an infrastructure that can help him,
right.
aid him in the decision-making process. It's just, he has no use for that or interest in it.
Ken?
One of the scariest things to me is not so much that he treats the White House as his family business, but his family business did not have the ability to make consumers buy his products or people rent his buildings or whatever. So that's why he has so many bankruptcies in his background. But now we have this cult following that drinks the Kool-Aid, literally, like Jim Jones and his dead followers drank the Kool-Aid. That's where that expression comes from. And he's telling people to go drink the disinfectant, and they're going and drinking the disinfectant. It's really scary, not only how he treats it, but that there are people who are willing to walk off the cliff with him.
Yeah, but Rick, one of the things I keep reading is that he thinks he's hurting the blue states. He thinks he's hurting voters that will not vote for him. And I wonder, as his staff, whatever staff is still left around him, that are telling him to stop having these pressers, is that not only is his polling numbers beginning to tank, but actually the people that are his base, and they will be hurt. They will die.
No, he doesn't. Listen, the last thing he cares about are the people who are his base. That's a fact. I mean, he wouldn't sit down and have dinner with those people that are voting for him. The people you see mm-hmm. protesting on state capitals, carrying guns and screaming, "Oh, reopen the stores." You know, he'll let them clean his toilets. He's not having them over for supper. So he doesn't care about that. He cares about him. But, you know, to that point of he treating the government like it is getting rid of people who disagree. You know, back there are plenty of stories back when he was running the casinos that there were people telling him, you can't get bonds at 20% and 22%. You'll never be able to pay them back. And he had put them and went forward. But see, that's because he always had a plan. The plan there was to skim millions of dollars off the top and bankrupt the casinos. And who cares? He doesn't care if they went bankrupt. Remember Donald Trump? People forget this. He said during the campaign, I don't know what you're talking about. I made plenty of money in Atlantic City. Yes, Donald Trump made millions of dollars in Atlantic City. Every single person who touched his property as a contractor or an investor lost money in those properties, but Donald made money. So it's always all about Donald.
Right. There's no, I mean, we somehow think that a leader should have a fiduciary responsibility to the organization.
He doesn't have that. He can't spell that, Rick.
He can't spell that.
So and he doesn't recognize it. He would not, right? He does not believe that that's his job. You said he wants to hurt the blue states. You're right. But here's what he doesn't get. 40% of the people in California voted for him. That's millions of people. Those people voted for him, but he would tank California tomorrow.
Well, but it's not, it's not voters, Rick. It's voters in red states. You see, voters that voted for him that live in places like California or New York or whatever state that didn't vote for him and he didn't get the Electoral College votes, those are totally expendable.
Right.
Because those were not voters of value. The only voters of value are the voters that bring him over the majority so he gets the Electoral College. I mean, again, this isn't, there's no allegiance to anyone. And let me just, we have to get to the story before we go to a break. So Val, I don't know why this completely broke my heart, but I went berserk. And it was from the New York Times and it was Sunday. Trump speech to bring 1,000 West Point cadets back to campus. The president's off again, on again speech in June will bring back cadets who had scattered across the country to help counter the coronavirus. I saw this story, maybe it was the end of the week. I went crazy. These kids did not sign up to go to a graduation to serve the ego of a madman. And what he is asking them to do puts them at risk, puts other fellow cadets at risk. Who knows what's going to happen? There is no point to this, except it's about basically massaging his ego. And they didn't do this for this purpose. They're willing to be patriots. They're willing to defend their country. They're willing to take on the, but this is over the top.
It's one of those unbridled moments by Donald Trump that has real consequences. And Donald Trump still does not understand that his words do have consequences. You know, to me, what was even more appalling is when he said that he didn't like the look of a socially distanced graduation, and he was hoping the look would be nice and tight. So what he's saying is that he doesn't want those graduates social distanced on top of that. And this was all about jealousy with Pence, who announced that he was giving a graduation address, I believe, to the Naval Academy. And he couldn't be outdone. But the consequences of this, I mean, and again, at West Point, they said, who are they to turn down the president? And he knew he had them over a barrel to be able to do this. So we're putting at risk 1,000 potential military leaders just because he wants the look and he needs the attention. It will turn into another partisan rally.
Well, but Dean, I mean, so it's not only that he's bringing them in, he's going to make them quarantine individually for 14 days in order for him to get the look. The look. That's what this is about. This is about an artificial impression that things are back to normal. I mean, it's everything about him is just so vile. I mean, what he did to the governor of Georgia, where he was praising the governor of Georgia until the governor of Georgia basically had done everything Donald Trump said he wanted him to do, and then he threw him under the bus because it was turning out to be not quite the good look he was looking for. I mean, this is just, it's just shocking.
Well, I mean, everything he has said and done for the past, at least for the past few weeks, has been geared towards trying to put as positive and optimistic spin on the situation as possible. You saw just the other day, you know, he said it's possible that the coronavirus will just go away over the summer, and we'll be back in business. And then, you know, Dr. Fauci got up immediately after and said, no, I'm positive we're going to have coronavirus in the fall. We just need to be prepared to control its impact. So everything he's done has really been geared towards, you know, getting this off his plate as quickly as possible so he can get back to a stronger economy and campaigning. We'll see. You know, I don't know when the West Point graduation, what day it's scheduled. We'll see if there is some sort of rethinking of that as people really start to consider the implications of him doing it in a way that he wants. But it is, it's been getting a lot of coverage. It is quite quite surprising that he's decided to do this and is kind of openly musing about what it's going to look like as a way of kind of, you know, letting people know up front it better look good.
So the other thing he also did this week, I can't believe it, Rick, it's only been a week. And it seems like if you're not focusing on his pressers and Clorox, there's just so much else that's happening. So he basically said that he's going to shut down all immigration to the United States. I mean, you can just see Stephen Miller is just like high five and everything because he's totally in control of this. As if there was very much immigration happening anyway. So let's be honest here. Virtually nobody's traveling anywhere and no one's coming in. But he does this because he says that this is a way of ensuring that Americans get the jobs that these immigrants will take. And then you find out that there's like enormous loopholes in his quote unquote shutting the immigration stream coming through. And who's the big loophole for? It's for farmers and pork producers. And it turns out that when it comes to that kind of immigration, well, we're going to wink and nod and that immigration can continue.
A wink and nod ought to be the name of his administration. That's he does that on a daily basis. I mean, you know, like he throws out this West Point thing, and I like Dean just said, we'll see if that really happens. You know, how many things has he said? Well, we may have to do this, and they may have to do that, and then they don't do it, but they get the headlines. You know what didn't get any headlines this week? What? The Republican Senate confirmed that the Russians interfered in the 2016 election. That didn't get a lot of press. I mean, we're talking about Clorox, we're talking about West Point, we're talking about him yelling at CNN reporters or moving seats around. You know, I just wonder, I don't want to give him any credit at all because I really just don't. But I wonder if it is just, you know, if somebody at least has the wherewithal to say, let's just keep doing all this crazy stuff because the crazy stuff keeps the real news out of the news.
Yeah, no, Val. I mean, I think Rick is absolutely yes. Right. I mean, yes. Even the immigration stuff didn't get the kind of traction it should have gotten. And what Rick said about what happened in the Republican-controlled Senate is shocking. But at the same time, I mean, you want to almost have a COVID-free hour every night on the air just to cover all the stuff that's happening that we're not paying attention to because both the COVID-19 and Donald Trump are such an incredible distraction that it's opened the door for them to do such incredibly insidious stuff.
And again, we get caught underestimating Donald Trump and his ability to divert the real news and for us to pay attention by doing those things. And we found over and over again that these crazy plans that he has are cumulative and they roll off his back. And so why wouldn't he continue along those lines? And so Rick's point is very well taken that we have to remember that Donald Trump does have a strategy.
Well,
and somebody said, where is Eric and Don Jr.? And I said, they probably over at Fort Knox taking all the gold out of the vault and nobody's paid any attention.
So let me say something, Dean. I'm not sure that Donald Trump is as brilliantly sophisticated as it would appear. But I think people around him love the fact that he is so vain and so obsessed with himself that the idea of all this stuff gives them the opportunity to basically have a license to do everything, whether it's immigration policy. It's almost like, I mean, they can play ball now at an incredible level that had only been a Republican wet dream before, but now it's reality for them. And so I'm not even sure he's as aware of some of the things that are happening, but this is their opportunity to have it all happen because the press isn't paying attention, because the media is so, I mean, the media is obsessed with COVID-19, legitimately so, because 50 states are hemorrhaging and in different ways. And it's an incredible story. And we're still at the beginning of the story. So everything is still so new that this is an opportunity, Dean, for him to get away with. You know,
but what's so amazing, Arnie, is I think about the conversation we've been having. None of this is surprising to me. This is all of a piece of what he has done since he's been in office, you know, the distractions. They've been dismantling regulations in the bureaucracy, you know, Department of Education, EPA, Health and Human Services, all kinds of, you know, environmental protections, you know, federal monuments, et cetera. This stuff's been going on since he got into office, and he has been kind of a useful distraction or decoy for some of these other folks to do what they're doing, and they've been doing it nonstop. Sometimes they get blocked in the courts, but a lot of it does not get blocked. So, yeah, everything we've talked about today, his disdain for experts, his unwillingness to listen to alternative points of view, his preference for a small group of loyal and obsequious advisors, all of that stuff is just basically, it's him. It's just sort of the way he is. The difference is now, you know, it's funny, you know, for 3 years or almost 4 years now, I've heard people say, yeah, all this is really bad, but imagine what's going to happen when we have a real national crisis. Well, now we have a real national crisis, and we're seeing the impact of all this. But I'm not seeing anything from him now
that is any different
from what I've seen over 3 years. Right, the only difference is, you know, 50 some odd thousand people have died in the last 2 months.
Right. The president as decoy. The president as decoy. I kind of like that, Dean. All right. Yeah. This is the first half of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1944. That was the day the Army National Guard seized the Chicago property of Montgomery Ward and removed its chairman, Sewell Avery. The Chicago-based company repeatedly refused to accept a National War Labor Board order to recognize the workers' union and abide by the board-negotiated collective bargaining agreements. After refusing the second board order, President Franklin Roosevelt ordered the Army National Guard to seize the company's central mail order house, retail store, and other related properties in the city. Avery was physically carried out of his office. Wartime no-strike pledges were in effect to avoid strikes or any disruption in war production. From a distance, it looked as if the president had triumphed the cause of labor in forcefully implementing the Wagner Act. Workers of the CIO United Mail Order Warehouse and Retail Employees Union had walked off the job over recognition issues on April 12th. Montgomery Ward officials argued again, as they had 2 years earlier, that they were not engaged in war production, held no government contracts, and that the dispute is not one which might impede the prosecution of the war by the board's own terms. But the government feared strike activity would only spread to other industries in Chicago and elsewhere. Local Teamsters and Railway Brotherhoods all supported the strike and refused to handle shipments to and from Ward facilities. The CIO union agreed to end the strike on the eve of the seizure. Others in the labor movement called FDR's move a hoax and a device to break strikes and get workers back on the job without any gains. Roosevelt issued a third seizure of Ward's facilities nationwide by the end of the year. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Welcome back to part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. This is a conversation with Rick Newman, a former state legislator, currently a lobbyist, with Val Endres, a professor of political communication at Rhode Island College, and Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. So there are stories that are happening that we have to pay attention to. And this one, I think, has huge consequences. And this is my Reuters lead. Trump threatens to block aid for U.S. Postal Service if it does not raise prices for Amazon. Rick. President Donald Trump on Friday threatened to block federal aid for the U.S. Postal Service unless it raises shipping rates for online companies like Amazon.com, prompting criticism that the move would hurt consumers relying more than usual on packages during the coronavirus outbreak. And Rick, if I am correct here, Amazon does a lot of its own delivery. I mean, I've seen the Prime trucks come by, but for rural America, which is Trump's base and which obviously now needs some kind of delivery, it is the U.S. Postal Service that does the last mile, you know, or the last 5 miles. And they're not going to send a Prime truck out to Cucamonga. It's going to be the U.S. Postal Service that has been servicing those places forever. So not only is he hurting his people, but people are talking about him wanting to insist upon raising the price of a stamp. Just as we're looking at, you know, vote by mail, how convenient is that? I mean, when you sort of play all these things together, as my good friend Stefan Schmidt says, Trump is diabolical. Rick?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I live in Nottingham, okay? We get deliveries from Amazon, and oftentimes I've noticed the last year or so, I never noticed before, maybe they weren't doing it before, but it's the post office that actually brings the package usually. Once in a while it's UPS, but it's usually the post office. When I saw him say that, I said to myself, this is a thing where I can see a crowd of his people standing up and cheering and saying, yeah, we got to get the postal service. And yet they don't understand. You're cheering to raise the price on yourself.
Yes. Now,
if he raises the price of a stamp, that means it costs you more money to send grandma a card. And it costs more money for a package to come to your house. Jeff Bezos no one else is going to eat that. That's going to be eaten by the people who get the service. It always is. And it just amazes me that he says that. And again, it goes back to what we said earlier, though. See, it doesn't matter to him about who it hurts. It is aimed directly at somebody he doesn't like.
Well, but Val, again, it's someone he doesn't like. So we know he hates Bezos. We know he hates the fact that he owns the Washington Post. Okay, let's put that on the table. But the irony of all this is that Bezos and Amazon have their own delivery system. So much of their business, it's those little tiny rural tchotchke places in, you know, Oklahoma and Nebraska that depend on Amazon, but not on Amazon delivery, because Amazon won't deliver to them. And it's because the post office has a reason for doing it, because it was created in the Constitution. It is everywhere. It is pervasive. It wasn't about making money. It was about making sure that we stayed connected. And even if they quadrupled the prices on Amazon, that is not the point. Amazon will hardly be hurt, but the post office will be devastated, and those people that will have to pay those increased prices, they will be hurt.
And they happen to be, as you said before, the Trump voters from the rural areas. And rural areas have taken enough of an economic hit to begin with. But I really truly believe, Arnie, that this is prompted by revenge. That he made the suggestion that he thinks that the post office should charge Amazon 4 times their normal price, and that was his suggestion for raising the prices. And he singled out Amazon, even though he talked about some of the other mass mailers along with that. And we had talked about before, and I do believe that the post office is taking a hit from Donald Trump because of the specter for him of vote by mail in November. So I think those two together are just revenge scenarios for Donald Trump right now. And ironically, what you said is that he's going to hurt the very people who are likely to vote for him.
Well, and Dean, the post office is saying that if they don't get any help from the federal government, they will probably go bankrupt and belly up and have to shut down practically in September. The convenience of this, just before everybody is banging on the door for mail by voting to protect people.
Right.
The timing, this is, you couldn't invent this the way he's doing this. And yet look what's happening. And then I remember I started the show by saying, not only do I want you to remember Colonel Vindman, I want you to remember Wisconsin. Why am I saying that? because the Supreme Court, as in the U.S. Supreme Court and the Wisconsin Supreme Court, made people vote during the middle of a pandemic. You saw just in one city, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, they had 180 polling places. They shrunk down to 5 because nobody wanted to man them given the pandemic. And as of this morning, they now can connect 40 COVID-19 positives to voting on that day. And that's assuming that people are even being tested. Yeah. You know that with the level of tests, it could be hundreds more.
Well, this is going to be, you know, other than dealing with the virus itself, this issue of ballot access, whether it's mail-in ballots or residency requirements or, you know, early voting, all this stuff is going to be the major front, I think, both at the state level, in the courts, and to some extent at the federal level as well, because I know some Democrats, Amy Klobuchar and others, are and maybe even Kamala Harris, I can't remember, but there's a couple of Democratic initiatives about mail ballots at the federal level as well. This is going to be the front going forward, because President Trump has made it very clear that he is going to tarnish mail ballots as indicative of high levels of fraud or easily fraudulent every chance he gets. And so this is something that's going to, you know, the states are going to take action. You know, democratically controlled states are going to work to liberalize voting opportunities. Republican states are going to work to constrain voting opportunities. I think you're going to see it on both sides. So, you know, he's had a bone to pick with the Postal Service as long as I can remember. You know, we'll see if Congress gets involved. You talk about the Postal Service potentially going bankrupt, et cetera. You know, I think the Congress will get involved at some point. But this is just the beginning of what's going to be a nasty fight over the summer and really right up until November.
Well, Val, let's take the bankruptcy thread, and then I'm going to go to Rick. So, Val, Mitch McConnell basically said that we should let the states go bankrupt and not bail out the states, not bail out the cities and towns. And that was his solution for what's, I mean, that all of a sudden, I tell you, Donald Trump has sort of infected the entire Republican Party. Bankruptcy are us is what they become. And they see that as an opportunity to do the kind of long-term permanent damage. And according to Mitch McConnell, he saw that if they put money into one of the bailout bills for states, that it was a blue state bailout. Every governor in the country is vomiting, including in my little state of New Hampshire. Chris Sununu is like, no. That's us too. No. I'm a good Republican. I mean, he has no idea how many Republican governors are like, don't you dare suggest this is a blue state bailout. And don't you dare suggest that we go bankrupt, Val.
Well, and I've seen the devastation that even a single city going bankrupt. We had a city in Rhode Island that went bankrupt, and there was a lot of pain involved in getting that city on its feet again. And we're not just talking about the state coffers and overage of money. We're talking about pensions for people who have worked for the state, which would greatly reduce the number of people who work in the state. We're talking about social services that it would decimate. But if you look at that, and if you look at where the Republicans want to shrink government, it is exactly there. And by not bailing out the states, you provide more money for corporate subsidies. And so I think that the two, the corporations and giving money to corporations or bailing out states, I think the two are connected.
But Rick, I mean, I was talking to someone the other day about how important the federal bailout dollars are during an economic downturn. And I used the story of New Hampshire, my little white wealthy state, okay? And the closest we've come from a really horrific economic downturn was in the late 80s and early 90s. Remember when we lost all our banks and we had two bankrupt utilities and it was a disaster. And I reminded my little state that we ranked number one in bailout money from the federal government through something called Metascam, where we scammed the Medicaid program and we got more per capita per dollar wise, that it turned out to be the largest revenue source funding the state of New Hampshire for 4 or 5 years. A scam on the federal government is how my little rich, you know, formerly Republican state was able to bail itself out. So every governor, Republican or Democrat, gets it. You know, they know that it's going to be far more than pensions. They're going to take it on a hit. And frankly, it's Republican governors who are up for re-election who are going to have to deal with Donald Trump as the leader of their party as they tell their states they're going bankrupt.
Yeah, and I remember Metascam. Of course, that was a Republican legislatures, and and that went on for years, and it kept New Hampshire afloat. Well, I'm reminded of the fact that during this bailout monies now, we've spent, what is it, closing in on $3 trillion. There has not been one member of Congress stand up and say, we should shut down the government over raising the debt ceiling.
Yes.
Every time Barack Obama wanted to buy a new cup of coffee, they wanted to shut down the government to raise the debt ceiling. And they must have voted several times to raise the debt ceiling. I haven't even heard the word. I bet if you Google debt ceiling, it hasn't been printed in a newspaper article in the last 3 years. And they were shutting it down every 6 months when Barack Obama was there. And of course, raising the debt ceiling has nothing to do with spending money. But again, now they're just throwing money at corporations. And we've got all these stories about Ruth Chris and everybody taking money they shouldn't have gotten, some of them giving it back and some not. But McConnell's idea that you're not going to deal with the state's problems and the municipality's problems under this crisis is absolutely ridiculous. You don't care about the states and the cities and towns. You're in huge trouble. Cities and towns do vital services.
So let me, let me say, so Dean, I want corporate America to scold Donald Trump. Because corporate America cannot handle not having firefighters, not having garbage pickup, not having the water services, not having kids in school, because it turns out that then what are they going to do with the children? Therefore, their little workers can't come into the corporations. I mean, I am waiting for corporate America to get a freaking spine and remind everyone that they can't function without the infrastructure of government, which makes them possible to excel, to achieve, and to actually perform at a high level. People need to connect the dots. And the only way that Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell can hear it is if corporate America stands up and says, you can't do this, you hurt us.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we've had this, I mean, I recall this debate's been going on for a while whenever candidates talk about the free markets and the, you know, corporations, and then people mention the importance of infrastructure and roads and electric grids and municipal waste pickup and all the things that you kind of take for granted. And I think it was earlier that I saw a map of the states that take the most federal dollars. And they're mostly in the South and the West, traditionally Republican strongholds. So it's kind of the irony of kind of free market ideology coming out of the Republican Party. And the reality is federal dollars are critical, especially for some of those states, for infrastructure and first responders and utilities and all the kinds of things that that we typically chalk up to, you know, the sort of corporations in the private sector. So the reality is something different than the kind of the way we people talk about it.
So Val, what I also think is interesting is that Mitch McConnell is up for re-election. His polling numbers aren't that great in Kentucky. And his governor is apoplectic about what he's saying about letting the states go bankrupt, because that's his own state, okay? And he's actually doing, I think, a very effective job of connecting with the constituencies in Kentucky. And I am looking at Mitch McConnell going, have you done your own polling numbers? Is this going to work for you? I mean, you want to maintain control of the Senate. You might not even maintain control of your own damn seat.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you're not bringing back the bacon. Isn't that always the thing they always do, Val? That's what senators love. Look what I brought you. I paid for that bridge. Look what I brought you. I paid for that program. And what's Mitch going to say to Kentucky? I paid for this bankruptcy. I mean, oh my God, Val.
I don't know why or what motivated him to say this, because we know, and as Dean had alluded to, Kentucky absolutely depends upon those federal dollars, as does many of the southern states, which again is a good part of Donald Trump's constituency, those GOP-led states. Yeah. So I'm not sure of what the motivation is. And on top of it, you know, we've worsened the problem because, and again, I think Rick alluded to this, about not having any oversight on the money that we're giving out in the first place. And again, I don't know whether McConnell was using that as a threat in order to get something else, whether he's looking for a corporate bailout, and so he's threatening to not support the states. And so it defies logic to me that he thinks that this would work.
It's shocking. All right, so Rick, this is my tweet of the day, everyone. And it was from Will Bunch from the Philadelphia Inquirer. If you haven't read Will Bunch, my recommendation is read him all the time. I adore him. But here is his tweet. And now both the People's Republic of North Korea and the USA have leaders in vegetative states. Oh, God, Rick. And you know, it's so interesting. North Korea is such a, it's in darkness. We know nothing about North Korea. I mean, even when you fly over North Korea, it's physically in darkness. It's always amazing to me to go from South Korea to North Korea, and literally there's a straight line where you can see where the border is because there's life on one side and then everything goes black on the other. But now what's happening with North Korea is so, so interesting because people have not seen him in a while. They know that he normally, I guess, takes a plane to his whatever home in one of the provinces in North Korea, and they saw that a train went there, which is so unusual because usually the only time people run North Korea take trains is when they're dead. But it's all these things are happening even at the same time, and to a large extent, it feels like Kim Jong-un sort of assumed that nothing could happen to him. You know, this was a disease of the little people. This is a disease of this, and I'm always wondering whether he contracted it too, just the way Boris Johnson did.
Yeah, and obviously I don't know what's going on in North Korea anymore than anybody.
Nobody does.
But, you know, at the risk of being a little crass, it strikes me that both countries currently have brain dead leaders.
Right. Right. That's exactly what Will Bunch said. It's like we have, you know, one we haven't heard from, but the one we've heard from has causing so much damage that it's just kind of absolutely shocking. All right, before I end up sort of saying au revoir, we keep talking about testing, Dean. And what I'm trying to figure out is what happened to this amazing nation that could invent anyone, send a man to the moon, that, you know, created the Marshall Plan, that understood how important it was to pivot, that I feel like we're fighting Trump even as we have to sprint to figuring out how to do the testing. But are we not able to do the testing because we don't have the capacity, or are we not having to do the testing because we don't have the leadership?
The communications on this particular issue are so confusing and contradictory, and you know, you've got the administration saying one thing, and then you've got, you know, leading epidemiologists from some of the top universities and think tanks saying something completely different in terms of what we need. Even the folks who are kind of stuck in between, particularly Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx, Fauci's been on TV saying, well, you know, we're not quite where we need to be, we're ramping up, but it's not the only thing we need to focus on. And Dr. Birx is sort of something similar where it's improving and we're making great strides, but, you know, it's got to be a joint effort with the states. You know, you really don't know who to listen to at this point. And you just kind of feel like, you know, it's just sort of is what it is. Some states are ramping up quickly, other states not so much. The federal government's probably not doing everything it could. You've got supply chain issues, technological innovation issues. It really is, you know,
actually reliability.
As what?
Reliability issues. One of the things I'm learning about is a lot of these tests aren't reliable.
Well, so, there are multiple tests. The FDA, the kind of the approval process isn't what it needs to be. So some of them give a lot of false negatives, false positives. It just really just is a, it's just a mess. There's no clarity and no kind of systematic thinking. And to the extent that there is systematic thinking by some of the leading epidemiologists at places like Harvard and Hopkins and elsewhere, what they're saying is so radically different from what the administration seems to be willing to do that it just seems almost kind of fruitless. you're just going to be what it's going to be. And I don't think we're ever going to get to where some of these epidemiologists say we need to be.
But Val, there was a Reuters story from April 25th that said in four U.S. state prisons, nearly 3,300 inmates test positive for coronavirus. 96% were without symptoms. 96%. So I posted this on Facebook and someone said, is this a good news story or a bad news story? Does that mean that most of the people that tested positive, are functioning fine and nothing, there's not a problem? And since everybody has it anyway, it's kind of the idea of the herd, what's that term? Where we all develop the immunity, herd immunity.
Calling the herd.
Right, the herd immunity.
Is this
good news? Or what does that headline tell us? Because it just scared the hell out of me.
Well, I think it's both devastating in one way and maybe tells us that the survival rates are better than we thought. But testing can't be done. I mean, if we're talking about reopening America, not only do we have to have the testing, but we also have to have effective means for tracing. And I did a bit of a deep dive into Obama's pandemic plan. And Donald Trump has, because of his enmity toward Obama, has done everything to reject that plan. But Obama had set in motion, for example, for pandemic training, and I think one of your articles mentioned this as well, is that you need 300,000 public health workers that are available and that are trained to be able to do the proper testing. And the Obama administration had been working on software in order to accomplish that goal. So, I believe that it's absolutely the federal government's responsibility for both testing and tracing. And we don't have the same kind of national leadership that we would have had under the Obama administration for something like this. But the tragedy doesn't end there. And I also believe that other countries in the past have looked to the United States for troubleshooting on these means. And they're bereft of U.S. leadership to try to figure out how do we go about doing this on a larger scale. So to me, it may be good news that a lot more people are living with COVID-19 than we thought. But on the other hand, it's unimaginable that we can open or reopen America without having effective testing in place and tracing in place.
Well, I'm going to say something. I think we're testing the wrong people. We should not test people who exhibit symptoms. We should test everybody else.
Yes, absolutely.
That's what this says. So let me just read you, Rick, three sentences. The numbers, this is from the prison. Numbers are the latest evidence to suggest that people who are asymptomatic, contagious, but not physically sick, may be driving the spread of the virus, not only in state prisons that house 1.3 million inmates across the country, but in communities across the globe. The figures also reinforce questions over whether testing of just people suspected of being infected is actually capturing the spread of the virus. Rick, it tells me I don't want to test people who I'm sure have COVID-19. I want to test everybody else because that's where the story is, Rick. It's not the people who are sick. It's me who's walking around, maybe not sick, who I might be, Typhoid Mary or whatever her name was. And I think we need to know that because that changes our behavior. And how sobering is that, Rick?
And that is the failure. That right there, that's the one thing. Why hasn't everybody been tested? He's been targeting everybody who wants a test will get a test. He said that a month ago or 6 weeks ago. And even forgetting about Trump himself because he can't do it. He's not capable of getting this done. Where are the people in the government that we thought we had? We were alive in your studio a couple of months ago, and we talked about this in a sense that people expect the government to protect them. We expect you to protect us from being invaded from foreign powers. We expect you to protect us from criminals invading our home. And this, we expect you to protect us. This is the failure of the government that just test everybody and figure it out. You know, this is like Bush's Katrina, except Katrina lasted for 6 months, is 3 days.
But it's because it's international in scope, Dean, and because all the countries are, I mean, Singapore thought it had dealt with it, and then Singapore opened up for business too soon, and they found out that they didn't. I mean, the idea of testing everyone, the problem is testing everyone how often? I mean, again, Dean, that's the other thing. I could be tested on Monday, but I could contract the virus on Tuesday. So, you know, I'm only as good as the hour that you test me.
There's one doctor I see on TV pretty regularly. His last name is Osterholm. I can't remember.
Oh yeah, from the University of Minnesota. I know. Yeah, and he's a good friend.
You know, he basically says, you know, you can do testing, and you know, maybe that will help kind of control the flow into our medical system. But the reality is, this virus is just going to keep going until 60 to 70% of the population is infected, and then we will have herd immunity. And it's very likely that that will happen before we have a vaccine. And he's just very matter of fact about it. It's a very kind of scary prognosis, but you know, the whole anybody who wants a test can have a test. That's just not going to happen.
His comments are being played out in the prison system. I mean, if you actually listen to Dr. Osterholm from the University of Minnesota, I know him very well. And because he used to be on the radio with me all the time. And when you listen to him, he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. And the problem is,
it's pretty gloomy, but
it's very gloomy. And the prison pointed it out, you know, and here, it shocked everyone that 95% of the people that tested positive exhibited niente in the way of anything that would have sounded like COVID-19, and they tested thousands and thousands. So I gotta thank Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, Rick Newman, lobbyist and former fellow from Newfoundland. How do you pronounce it? Newfoundland?
What? Newfoundland?
Canada, get out of here. And Val Endres from Rhode Island College, and of course, Ken Barnes, my producer. All right, everyone, this is The Attitude with Artie Artisan. We will see you at the map. Ciao.